Good afternoon and welcome to the Sitka Nature Show. This is your host, Matt. I want to thank you for joining me here as we start the second full week of January 2017. Been some brisk weather recently, and as forecast to continue on in for the next week or so. I'm recording this live with my guest, Kitty LaBounty, today. It's Saturday. The show airs tomorrow, so if you're listening to this, unless you're listening to on my website, we were recording last night after a, well, I guess it's a fairly breezy day. You were not even sure you were going to come in this evening, in which case I would have relied on some other conversations I have recorded for future shows. But yeah, maybe you'd like to share a little bit about what you were seeing from your house today.
Well, it's kind of it's pretty great living out on an island overlooking Eastern Channel, because at least this time of year, well, most of the times of the year, because there's been lots of whales blowing, and so there's lots of spouts and things like that. But today, the outflow event that had been discussed frequently on the news and on weather reports finally kind of hit Eastern Channel in a big way. So it seemed like the winds were probably blowing down over the top of Baranof Island and down Eastern Channel. And the gusts were pretty fun. They were picking up, you know, piles of water and kind of what looks to me, I don't know if this is the right verb for it, but like scudding. You know, they're kind of the water waves are kind of moving along. And at first you're like, is that a whale? Then you're like, no, it's the wind. So it was pretty exciting looking south from my house. And when I would walk out on the porch to get more firewood or whatever, it was like howling. And the trees were flying all over the place. And I was like, do I want to go to town? No.
Well, and for folks that live, in, as I do, in sort of the central part of town and maybe even out the roads a little ways, if you didn't go out and look at the water at Silver Bay, or even probably if you, I talked to somebody today who had gone out to Stargavin end of the road and saw that the wind was also blowing out of Catlian and hitting, getting some white caps lifted up there. But you might have been like, what wind? I mean, my house, it was yesterday on Friday, it was pretty gusty at my house. And I'm not sure what changed, if it was maybe just a slight change in the wind direction put us more squarely in the shadow, you know, the wind shadow of Vrstovia and Gavin Hill. But I, when I had heard that from you that it was windy out your way, I thought, oh, I'll go check out Silver Bay. So I drove out the road to Silver Bay and was watching from there. And it was interesting because in Silver Bay, you know, there was definitely the gusts that were moving out Eastern Channel out in the direction of your house. And they were coming, you know, out of kind of out of Blue Lake area and blowing and sometimes hitting the water hard, just, you know, at the larger turnout there before you get to the industrial park. I stopped there and watched for most of the time. And there were, you know, you could see the gusts hitting the water hard. And then as you were describing, you know, picking up the spray off the waves that were created, and then just like it was gusts of you know, if it were a dust storm, it'd be gusts of dust, but it wasn't. It was spray instead. But the other thing that was really interesting to me is there was a, you know, a somewhat calmer patch of water. I mean, it was still obviously windy there, but then right off of Herring Cove, I guess is kind of where it was, and just a little bit from there towards Bear Cove was just this big mess of like waves constantly, and then these things were blowing across. But what was really cool were these, you know, if I saw them on land, I'd call them dust devils. I don't think they were big enough to be like real water spouts, but definitely had that spiraling motion going up. And you know, you could see the waves sort of kicking up and splashing. I don't know that they were very big, but they were definitely frothy. And then like a column would come up of spinning, which you could watch. And that was a lot of, I actually took some videos of that, and that was fun. Were you getting the kind of the spirally things going on?
Yeah, that's why at first when you glanced, it was like, oh, there's a whale. Then you look back and go, no, that's not a whale. I mean, because it had that same sort of shape. I mean, it was bigger than a spout of a whale. But, you know, when you're catching something out of the corner of your eye, yeah. So I did see that, yes. But like I mentioned a few times, besides the wind being crazy out there, the whales are incredible in Eastern Channel, and have been for the last 3 weeks. So if anyone gets a chance, if somehow you get a chance to go out to Eastern Channel and watch whales, it's an incredible show. We've been watching tail slapping and group feeding and what looks like group feeding from where we are. Of course, we're watching from the house. So with binoculars or a spotting scope or even without those. So it's just been really great. So I'd encourage people to get a friend to help you get out there.
Well, I was actually just speaking with somebody earlier this week who mentioned kayaking out. It's not that far if you're starting at Crescent Harbor, and I wouldn't recommend it on a day like today.
No, it's probably not a good day.
Probably not even in a boat today, unless you had a pretty sizable boat and were happy in the wind. But on the calm days that we had earlier in the week, and it was quite calm. You know, the beginning last Sunday was Christmas bird count, and the seas were there was a little bit of wind that day, and then seas were settling down on Monday and Tuesday. And I mean, out at the buoy was under 3 feet for a day or two there midweek before this outflow event started to kick up. And so he talked about just kayaking. He says, you know, it's half hour or so, and you're out to Eastern Channel from Crescent Harbor, and you can just sit there. And when it's calm, you're bundled up warm, but then the sun feels warm and the reflection off the water feels warm. So you have your cup of tea or whatever, and then you're just comfortable out there sitting. And there's not much boat traffic this time of year, especially if you have a chance to go during the week. And so you can just kind of go out there and relax and see the whales, not getting too close because that would be scary, but, you know, they're just all out there. And I don't know if this is unusual. I mean, it seems like there's been other years where there's quite a few whales around, but I don't know if this is
pretty normal. It's for Christmas break, usually what ends up happening with me is I become somewhat of an island hermit. I take full advantage of the time to get to spend out there because there's usually piles of whales, and if it's sunny, my house is in full sun most of the day. So when you were talking, I was thinking that we picked the lot out to buy in January, one cold January, because of that reason. The sun was on it, and it was really warm and really nice. So it's a perfect spot. So, but getting back to your question, most Christmas breaks, it seems like, are really good whales. I mean, I'm not, you know, haven't kept track of numbers, but it seems like that's a regular thing.
So they're out there. The weather isn't always conducive to getting out there.
No.
And you mentioned earlier that the wind was hitting your house, and your house is kind of at the top of the hill. But can you go down sort of the slope below your house and be out of the wind, basically, and still in the
sun? If you go a little bit towards the west side, mm-hmm. Yeah. But the wind's kind of sneaking over. I was over on we walk around the lake all the time. There's a quarry lake in the center of Glencoe Island, too. So we walk around the lake, and we're looking for the spotted towhee that's been hanging out in the neighbor's garden, basically. And the wind was just actually starting. I thought, oh, we'll be real protected over there because that's on the west side. But the wind was actually starting to come over the top. And ended up on that side as well. So I don't know if there was really any spot, you know, maybe if I went far on the west side in the trees.
Well, one of the things, I mean, that's interesting to me is the difference that sort of micro topography makes, the slopes and the mountains and so forth, you know, on a somewhat larger scale than I was, you know, talking about at your house, but, you know, that it's calm in the central part of town and just howling out at Silver Bay, for example. And there's a number of sites that you can pull up. Windy.tv is one where you can pull up these maps and it shows the winds and so forth. And so I was curious about that. I was looking at that, and it shows actually most of Sitka, like the big winds are further north and actually a couple places south. And most of Sitka Sound is kind of in this shadow effect is what it's looking like there. But it doesn't. If that's true, then I'm kind of wondering what the real stuff looks like after seeing what was happening in Silver Bay today. But I suspect what's going on is the forecasts just aren't detailed enough to be able to resolve those little differences. But on an even smaller scale, even today when I was out, I took my daughter out to Silver Bay to see the wind pulling everything up. And we walked down to a place near the shore, and in one spot we just like could barely stand up in the wind. It was just howling through, but just not even 30 yards away, it was calm, and it was calm, and the sun was shining there, and it was just a little like the hill behind us was just high enough, and the wind was ripping, you know, nearby, but right where we were was calm and warm in the sun, you know, mm-hmm. reflected up off the water. And so one of the things I really enjoy about this time of year and, you know, your story about choosing your lot reminded me of that is just the sun, how, you know, I guess I, not that you ever take the sun for granted here, but in the winter, because there's so little of it and so little daylight and so forth, and it's cold, like the warmth of the sun just feels that much more like precious, I guess. And so so that's one of the things that I like to do is find those little nooks that don't have the wind blowing, especially right on the water where you get the reflection coming up. And you can almost pretend that it's sort of summer.
Sort of.
As long as you don't take too many layers off. But, you know, you feel the warmth of the sun on your face. And if you're wearing dark clothes, you can feel the warmth of the sun sort of coming through your clothes. And so that's one of the things that I like to look for this time of year, which is why I was curious if there's a spot down below your house that's got enough of a hill to block the wind.
Well, if I remember right, we sat down right at just above the... just above the rocks, just above the tide line. So it was dry. It was above the barnacle zone. And that's where it was all sunny.
Oh, yeah.
Because it was still all forested, right? So it hadn't started, we said, started clearing to build the house yet. So, yeah. So there were spots. There were definitely spots there. But, yeah, I definitely appreciate living out there on the sunny end of the island for sure. It's yeah, kind of whippy wind right now, but the sun is, like you said, very precious. My daughter and I have been going for walks, you know, not just on the island but in town, and we were picking our trails based on, well, is it in the sun or not?
Well, and the conditions of the trail can, like, if it's a trail that is in the sun, there's a... you know, when it was slightly warmer, there was a lot more melting that took place. Now it's cold enough, it's not melting anyway. But so I've noticed I walked up the new connector from Baranoff Street to that connects into the Cross Trail, formerly the Lower Gavin Trail, but now they don't quite hook up directly anymore. And it was interesting to me there was there were places where there was very little like ice and it was gravel, you know, or just a little bit of ice. And then there were places where it was packed snow, ice stuff and little hollows. But in those hollows were also where the hoarfrost had, you know, mm-hmm. was, you know, inch long crystals that were on everything. And there was this line and you could tell where the sun got high enough and shone because the frost, I don't know if it fully melted, but it was enough to warm probably the branches that it was on, and then it dropped off. And so there's these lines where it was just like winter wonderland of magical frost formations and then normal trees and brushes and stuff just above that where the sun was shining. And you could actually, I noticed you could hear the sort of tinkling of the frost crystals. It was quiet enough back there. And if you listen carefully, you could kind of hear them. I don't know how, just little kind of crystalline tinkles, mm-hmm. I guess, which was kind of my audio vocabulary fails me there. Just imagine what that might sound like. But it was fun. It was nice. It was a nice, and it's not been like frigid, so it's not been, you know.
The air temperature is actually, I mean, the actual temperature isn't bad. When I was listening to all these forecasts coming out, I decided, well, maybe a tarp isn't going to be enough over my carrot bed. I usually grow a lot of carrots and more. And the last year I left them in the ground. I just kind of cover them up with a tarp and some seaweed and all that. And then just would pull out portions of it as I wanted them. But I kind of panicked the other day. I was like, okay, I don't want to lose all my carrots because I didn't dig them. You know, I don't want to get too complacent about this cold. So I went out with a shovel, pulled back the tarp, and the tarp actually helped quite a bit. There was just like a little, like a crust mm-hmm. of the surface of the soil was frozen, broke through that really easily, and all the carrots were fine. Well, so I dug them all up, but I noticed when I was out there, I was like, I felt a little foolish because it seemed, it's like, you know, really, it's not that cold. And maybe if I had had a little bit more mulch or whatever, I could have just done that. But it was like, I'm already in here with my shovel. I might as well dig everything up.
Well, I did. I mean, I heard rumors of people saying like, "Oh, it's going to get down by zero or something." I was like, "Well, maybe one of the forecasts I've noticed sometimes on the online sites, some of them are way off, like 20 degrees colder than." And I'm almost wondering if their point is on the mountains or something, and so, you know, the forecast point is off. I don't know what's going on there, or if people got mixed up because like up north, I think Elfin Cove is probably getting hammered by wind and cold
and
much more than we
Juneau,
are.
Downtown yeah.
Juneau had 94 mile an hour gusts at the library, and I think the Sheep Mountain was well over 100 miles an hour.
Yeah, and it looked like though the airport in Juneau looked okay.
So it's one of those little micro.
Yeah, it's another micro thing. Now, who knows? Maybe I clicked on the wrong button to get the right thing. But at any rate, we've been very fortunate in terms of temperature, although I'm still happy that I hedged my bets with the carrots thing. But one of the things I've been doing when I've been cowering in my house watching – enjoying the sunshine through windows and avoiding the wind is looking at all the juncos in the yard.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's been a lot of juncos. My son moved our feeding operation away from where I see them most easily to because apparently the pigeons were getting the food there, and so I don't see the juncos in our yard as much. But I've had a couple people have mentioned that there seems like a lot more juncos this year, and I'm guessing at least in part, that's just due to the weather. The last two winters have been so mild that, and it's not like this is a really fierce winter. It's not been super cold. It's just been freezing, and there was some snow. And so, I think the juncos have moved into the neighborhoods maybe more strongly than they have in years past. And if you are seeing juncos, we did do a banding study this fall. I think I mentioned it a couple times in prior shows and certainly have in prior years, but that doesn't mean everybody remembers or has heard. We've been getting a few reports of banded birds. One interesting one was a song sparrow that was banded at Blatchley this year, showed up on Verstovia Street. And was told about that. And that's the furthest we've seen a banded song sparrow move. Not that it's that far. I think it's probably less than a mile, but so far,
conservative.
Yeah, so far all the song sparrows, well, they're moving somewhere in the summer, but where they're here, they're seeming to be pretty much right in the neighborhood where they were banded. So that's interesting. It'll be interesting to see if that one continues to show up there. But certainly it's worth checking your junco flocks. We banded out at Shotgun Alley this year, banded at
Blatchley.
I think we tried at the high school, but there weren't any birds.
We did an epic fail there.
Banded a few at my house in the kind of the central neighborhoods, kind of near Market Center. There any? And then on Galenkin Island.
Yeah. Geez, I feel like I'm missing a spot right now, but those are the spots that come to mind.
And so in prior years, we also banded out above C-Mart on Edgecombe Drive. Mm-hmm. So there could still be some birds returning from that banding. So it is worth just keeping an eye out, looking for the color bands, and we'd like to know whether there's, they have left and right legs, and they could have up to two bands on each leg. So the color combination, which one was on top, which one was on the bottom, and then which leg. That allows us to tell where that bird was banded and when, for the most part. So,
and it takes a little practice to see them. I have one pair of binoculars that is just it's like set to the focal length that I need to see most of the birds that I'm at the window that I'm looking at. And I keep them right by the window, and I keep my notepad right by the window. Because some of the combinations are a little complicated. We tried to, use good contrasting colors, but over the years it's like we've learned over the years, so some color combinations may not be as easy to notice, and the birds do not always stand in a nice tidy way that you can see their legs. So be patient with yourself and with a bird. We really appreciate folks taking a look at them and noting them and giving us information. And I'm especially excited because now we have banded birds out Shotgun Alley and Jamestown Bay sort of area. So we don't know what those birds are doing yet. I have kind of more of an idea because we've had more years in with the birds in kind of the central part of town, but it's cool to see what's going on out east.
Well, and this is the second year that we banded it at Shotgun Alley with Gwen Bayless. And so dark-eyed juncos are by far the most numerous banded, but also a few chickadees and a few song sparrows have been banded, plus some miscellaneous other birds, but they only have an aluminum band. And in fact, if you can get pictures, that's ideal, actually. And I know a lot of people have digital cameras, but if you can just make note of the band combinations, a nice platform feeder, or if you have food out in the yard, makes it a little easier. As you say, it can be a little difficult. They move and then they kind of sit down on their legs a little bit sometimes. But the chickadees, there was one interesting one was The first year, so that was, I guess, in 2000, was it in fall of 2012, I think, was our first year that we banded. And we banded, I think, three chickadees at my house that year. And one of those chickadees we saw, or it was reported mostly by me or my kids, probably almost entirely by me or my kids, at around my house. And then I saw it later in the summer, actually, down the road towards Swan Lake. So not that far away, but it was interacting at a nesting spot. I don't know whether it was nesting or whether it didn't seem like my impression at the time wasn't that it was the nesting bird, but that it was curious about the nest. Whatever that might mean for chickadees. But then earlier this winter, my son noticed a banded chickadee and turned out to be one of the other birds banded in 2012. Mm-hmm. It had not been reported. I think it had been reported once after the initial banding that same winter, and then never again until just this year. And so, you know, that begs the question, was it around and we just didn't notice, which is entirely plausible and probably likely, but it's interesting that this is now, you know, it's a 5-year-old bird now, at least, I guess. And I don't know how old juncos live, but chickadees, but the same for song sparrows and juncos. Any of those birds now that are starting to show up from the first year or two are starting to get, they're getting to be pretty old. And they're
for birds.
Yeah, for birds. Yeah. Especially those kind of birds. I mean, some birds live a long time, but for the small songbirds. And so there's some interesting things. We did a little work this fall. You did most of it, kind of compiling information and stuff that we've got. And there's a poster, I guess, you have set up now. And maybe
I should print it.
Yeah, maybe if you can get it printed and just have it on display at some of the natural history talks that are coming up.
And maybe I could have it on display at the next natural history talk.
Yeah, huh. that was very leading. There will be one of the things that we like to talk about this time of year when you're a guest is the natural history seminar series. So we'll go ahead and talk about that now. So you've been organizing it. I think this is now the 11th year. Is
I think
right?
so.
Yeah. We started it at Sheldon Jackson College and ran it 1 year there on essentially no budget. And then SJ closed, and you took it over and have run it all on your own. But we had applied for and received
definitely
it.
Definitely have help.
Well, we had applied for and received some funding from the Sitka Charitable Trust after that first year, just for, you know, not even a lot of money, but enough to bring in some folks to talk, pay for travel. And so with that, you were able to kind of do what needed to be done to get that money transferred over to whatever organization was then the holder of it, and have since that time kind of organized the Natural History Seminar Series, which, I don't know, it'd be interesting to count up how many different talks. You probably don't have that number off the top of your head.
If I could pull up my report, I could tell you. It's probably on my computer here, but I won't put people through that, listening to me count 1, 2, 3.
Roughly 8 to 10 a year, so
yeah.
We're probably
yeah,
pushing close to 100
more.
Talks.
Yeah.
So.
And I've been really pleased with the people who are willing to come, and I'm to come over, because I don't pay them. We just pay for their travel and house them somewhere and sometimes feed them. I mean, it's basically they're volunteers, and I've been really happy that people have been interested and willing to volunteer to do the talks. And we've also been beneficiaries of the Sitka Sound Science Center's SURF program. And by the way, I'm on the board of the Science Center, and the grant now goes to the Sitka Sound Science Center, just to be clear about that. And it's a nice cooperative agreement with the University of Alaska and the Science Center, with, of course, the very generous and helpful funding of the Sitka Charitable Trust. And now the Park Service as well has kicked in a little money to help bring some other people from further afield. So I'm really happy to have all the support and the volunteer speakers who are stupendous.
And I know there's, you know, as one of the folks that are regular, is a regular attendee, I know there's a kind of a core of people that seem to come to almost every talk, and then depending on the subject, you know, a mix of other people. And usually pretty good turnouts. And I am actually going to be giving the next talk, which, if I remember correct, is the 19th of January.
It's a Thursday.
A Thursday evening, 19th of January. So a little over a week after this, about a week and a half after this show is airing. And yeah, I have not given a talk for this series since the very first year when it was run at Sheldon Jackson.
We all gave a talk last year, though.
Well, that's true. I've not given a solo talk. I did help out with the birding in Alaska talk. The first year it was mostly local folks. I think we managed mm-hmm. to get one or two people that were not local. Who had some money, and actually we did get a little bit of funding from the college to bring in Mary Wilson. Mm-hmm. So it's been mostly folks from out of town who have been here either as serfs or that you've brought in specifically to give talks or maybe have been in town for another reason with a smattering of local folks. So it's a nice mix, nice opportunity to learn about natural history. And my particular topic, which maybe you're curious to know about, because I've told you a little bit about what I'm going to talk about.
Yeah, what are you going to talk about?
What am I going to talk about?
Like, what's the title, man?
Well, I don't have my title yet because I'm probably too clever for my own good or want to be too clever. So I'm maybe working a little harder than I need to about that. But yeah, what I'd like to talk about is just being excited about natural history and everything that's out there and around and some of the stuff that I've, you know, sort of picked up over the years, learned over the, it's been almost 20 years since I started down the rabbit hole of natural history. I didn't start as a kid. I was just like a kid that ran around and played. We didn't, nature, whatever. That's just the woods
it's
where
just
we play.
There. Yeah.
And so, you know, there were certainly things that I knew about, but there was far more that I didn't know about. And so it was as an adult that I really started intentionally learning about nature. So I want to just talk a little bit about that and then how, for me, like curiosity has really been a driving force. And I suspect that most people have sparks of curiosity, which they may not always cultivate fully. But if they do, you know, there's so much energy that comes out of curiosity and sort of following that curiosity. And so I just kind of want to start there and then really talk more about a couple of, a project that we're kind of collaborating on this year, which I'm sort of calling the Sitka Big Year Project, very, you know, creatively named there. A couple different years now, I've done personal big year projects where I was like, and I call them 1,000 species projects. My goal was to see 1,000 species in, or try and find 1,000 species in 1 year. And at the time that I was doing them, I think the first year was 2007, and I think I made it as far as about 65. And I really got bogged down because it was difficult to track it, really. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to, I tried to keep up a weblog, and you can still find that weblog if you know where to look. And I think 60,
and he might even tell you
65. Yeah, it's hidden on my website somewhere, but, I think I made it to about 65 species that year before I just ran out of steam. And then in 2012, I tried again. And by that time, I had myself an app in my phone that I could use to record birds and plants. And I did that. And that worked a lot better, except for there was a lot of stuff that when I photographed it, when I saw it, I didn't know what it was. And so I think I probably had 500 or 600 different things that I put into my phone, most of which I knew what they were. And then there was a whole slew of other things that I had no idea what they were, and I was just taking pictures of them. And so I ended up with, I don't know, I think now that I've edited it down, it's a little under 7,000 photos, but it was more like 12,000 photos when I started, I think. Maybe it was only
10. Still sounds fairly overwhelming.
It was a lot of photos. So over the last few months, what I've done is I've gone and I put them into iNaturalist. And iNaturalist is it's really pretty amazing tool online. You can have it as an app in your phone or you can just use it online. And it allows you to post pictures and get help identifying things. And then it keeps track automatically of what you're seeing.
And so we'll spend a little time, I'm using the royal we, I guess. I'm not going to be talking at all at this talk, but I'm hoping that that iNaturalist will get a little feature time.
Yeah,
at the talk.
I plan to talk a little bit about it, not a lot, because what I'd like to do later is run a weekend hour to some Saturday morning or something mm-hmm. specifically geared towards helping people work with iNaturalist and try it. It's fairly straightforward, you know. It's technology. So, I mean, you've used it a little bit.
Yeah, I've used it a little bit. And I think it is mostly straightforward. It's like a lot of things. It's like, it's not necessarily totally intuitive. But usually if you're willing to like be a little click crazy and ask questions, you can get things going. And once you get things going, I'm sure there's smoother and more sophisticated ways to do them, but I'm working fine on my my not so sophisticated way. So I've been trying to keep up with this multi-species project as well. And I figured if I get an average of 3.5, whatever a 0.5 species is, a day, then I can make 1,000 species.
Well, that would get you over 1,000, right. Except for you're allowing for travel.
I'm allowing for travel, yeah. And I'm just kind of trying to work through it. And I can't remember how many I've posted so far. And I'm trying for the first time not just to have a name for things, because I can walk around in the woods and name lots of things, because there's lots of plants and bryophytes and birds and yada yada. But I'm actually trying to take pictures. My bar for my pictures is pretty low. The bar for the pictures that you will see at Matt's talk is pretty high. So you can come and listen to Matt's stories, but you'll also want to come and look at his pictures. So
yeah, I will try to high grade my photos. I certainly have plenty of lousy photos, and I'll probably share some of those just as examples.
To make us feel better?
Well, just as examples, because that's the thing. As for iNaturalist, there are certainly photos which you can't do much with. And so they don't have to be like aesthetically satisfying photos to be useful photos. And so one of the things that, again, I won't talk about so much at the talk, but I think as we do, you know, as we get later into the season, you know, we could do a Saturday morning kind of workshop on, okay, here's how to photograph plants to maximize the chance that we can figure out what it is. Because sort of the view from 30 feet back of a flower, you know, that's a tiny little thing is not. Sometimes you can figure out
sometimes
what it is.
Sometimes it's pretty obvious, and other times I've wanted to, like, cry.
Yeah.
Because I feel bad when I can't help people identify plants, because that's my thing, right? I'm a botanist, but I'm used to identifying them in hand or in place.
Yeah.
And it's really different when you're looking at a flat picture from one angle where you can't necessarily see the clues that you're used to seeing. So the giving people those hints will be really handy because I don't like to cry.
It's not just plants, but things like, you know, snails. Turns out that there's three views of a snail that's useful. And with that, you can pretty much identify any snail, apparently, which was news to me until recently. And Paul Norwood, who's been a guest on the show before, and 2 years ago now, he did his own sort of 1,000 species project, and he fully utilized iNaturalist. And prior to that time, I'd known about iNaturalist, but I hadn't really used it much because I was doing my own thing. But when I saw how it was working for him on that, that's what really kind of converted me to using it more as a way of just organizing observations. And so prior to this year, you know, my projects have been very kind of personal, and I had the year-long 1,000 species project and sort of the can I document 1,000 species in total, and I'm up to well over 1,000 now that I've documented at some point in the Sitka area. But this year I thought, you know, it'd be fun to have a lot more people. And so, yes, I'm going to be trying to find as many species as I can find and stretch my boundaries about things that I don't know that much about, like fish and intertidal stuff and more bryophytes and more lichens. And so there are definitely things out there that I don't know that much about. And I would like to learn more about. But my hope is that in general, we'll get a lot of people involved in this. You know, whatever level you're interested in, maybe you're interested in plants or maybe you're interested in birds. If you're observing something and you can take a picture with your phone or a digital camera, you know, you can get involved in this project or just show up for the workshops, even if you're not gonna be submitting stuff to iNaturalist just for fun. And my hope is, and we haven't planned out all the details of the kind of workshops and stuff, but I would like it. In my mind, what I hope is that if somebody participates in all the things that we offer over the year, that they could get 100 species. I mean, that seems pretty reasonable. It'd be birds and plants and things like that, that over the course of the year, they will have at least seen and I don't know if they could continue to recognize all 100, but at least at one point seen them and known them, been understood what
right.
they were and what
well,
their
that could
name
be
was.
Part of the beauty of their own iNaturalist observations is because they can go back to them.
Yes.
You're
yes.
essentially building your own little booklet. You know, there's lots of guidebooks and lots of things out there, but sometimes it's really nice just to, you're basically creating your own with your little pictures
yeah.
and the names, and these are the things that have caught your eye and that you're interested in, so you can go back to them yourself. It doesn't need to be 5,000 things.
No, it doesn't, and I'm a little over-obsessed, maybe. I don't expect anybody else to be that way, but I think collectively, you know, there are folks that are out there fishing and they're catching whatever fish that might be junk fish to them. Like they're just going to toss back, but they could snap a photo of it.
Mm-hmm.
And
I think there's a lot of people that would be interested in that information,
yeah.
Not just the people in this room.
Oh, yeah. So it is, you know, iNaturalist is a, you know, citizen science kind of site as well. So it's set up that you can do your own stuff there. But there are serious scientist types that use it for ecology and biodiversity work. The information, if it achieves a certain level of quality, which basically means that multiple people agree on a species identification, then it gets shipped out to the GBIF, which is the Global Bioinformatics Database, I think it's called. It's kind of a big, massive global database for biological information. And so your data gets used in that way. So location, time, place. That error species data mm-hmm. gets used and compiled in ways. So it does allow people, and I use it for myself. It's not so much for Southeast Alaska. It's interesting. Southeast Alaska, there's a lot of stuff from Sitka because Paul and myself have done quite a bit. And then my son has done quite a bit. And then Kent Bovee has a high school class mm-hmm. that does it some as well. So there's quite a few observations for Sitka. There's a couple of other people that I think are from Southeast and come back and visit and use it. And then you get this random smattering of tourists who use it. And mm-hmm. so you get these interesting, and most of those are going to be your charismatic megafauna with the occasional like striking yellow pond lily, for example, or something mm-hmm. that stands out to them. So it's been fun to see that, but I'd really like to see kind of a more diverse set of people. If you're listening to this outside of Sitka, this particular project is limited to the Sitka area specifically, like what's automatically pulled in.
But we still want to see what's happening in Pelican.
Exactly. Yes. Pelican, Elfin Cove, Tenneke, all of those places, it'd be great. You can get on iNaturalist. It's iNaturalist, just this one word, mm-hmm. .org. And look for that if you're interested. And please share your observations. I actually look at every observation that gets posted from Southeast Alaska. And I try and identify it if I can, or at least as well as I can. I don't know everything that people post, but I'll try to help out with the identifications there. And it's been really interesting to see what, you know, quality of photos is uneven. Some of them are pretty much impossible to identify, but most of them are pretty decent. And so that's been a fun thing. And I think right now we're up to over, even just a week in, we're up to over 60 species with mm-hmm. five different people having unknowingly contributed. I think you and I are the only ones that are contributing. But anybody that posts from Sitka area, that is the city, and it's within the city and borough of Sitka boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody who posts something, an observation from there will get counted. So we'll get a few tourists, I'm sure, but hoping for quite a few locals. I think I could make up some numbers, but I think it'd be nice.
It'd be fun.
Yeah, it'll be fun.
It's actually a really cool tool. I think that people would be really happy learning about it for themselves. Despite whatever, you know, regardless of this project and all that, I think that it's a really handy tool that I think a lot of people could make use of.
Yeah, and I hope so. And I hope this is kind of inspiring, for whatever reason, a lot of people like lists and numbers and counts, like mm-hmm. not doing a lot with numbers, but counts is kind of fun. So I'm hoping that we can get 1,500 species collectively. I don't think I'll get that myself. I might be able to find 1,000, but 1,500 collectively seems doable to me, including, you know, terrestrial and marine stuff. So if you're interested in that, come to the talk on the 19th at UAS, 7:30. And I'll have pictures there of prior, just things that I found, you know, diversity, the like my cool pictures. Basically, it's like the things that I think are kind of cool.
They
pictures
are nice
of,
pictures.
Of interesting things. I don't know a lot about all of them. But for me, you know, it's just knowing that it's here to start with and then like starting to recognize, oh, there's that again, or I haven't seen that one before. So that's part of the fun of going out to me is just going out and seeing, like, I don't know, you get that excitement. It's for me, it's that Christmas, well, I guess it's the holiday season, right? So it's Christmas morning excitement. It's like, ooh, there's something new. I'm excited. Mm-hmm. And there's that feeling that like when I find something new that I know is new and like I recognize that this is new and maybe unusual, like that's exciting for me. And so Maybe that's what I'm chasing. Maybe I'm a dopamine junkie or whatever it is that that's getting fired off in my brain when I find new things. But that's one of the things that I've enjoyed about my obsession with natural history over the past several years. So I'm not the only one speaking this year. I don't know. I know often this time of year you've only sort of started planning out the talks for the spring, and then the fall usually comes later. But do you have anybody sort of already lined up that you're
like that's solid?
Well, okay, or semi-solid?
Solid, solid. Yeah. Absolute. Well, I mean, as much as anything could be, knock on wood. February 9th, the scientist in residence fellow over at the Science Center, Nicholas Pyensen, and I'm sure I've mutilated his name and I apologize, from the Smithsonian Natural Museum. What? National Museum of Natural History. I can't even read my own writing, as usual. We'll be talking about whale phylogeny, so where whales came from. I think that'll be really interesting.
So that's, in some ways, a little bit of a follow-up if folks saw the Whale Fest keynote at the banquet from Ray Troll, who was talking about fossils and where things came from, not whales only, but I think whales came in there.
And then Pat Druckenmiller was here in November talking about Alaska fossils. So it's all kind of flowing together in a lovely way. I am trying to get someone, or I'm working on dates for a gentleman to come over from Glacier National Park to talk about the Kittlitz Murrelets surveys and work and their population that's going on there. We're juggling dates right now. I have, I just forgot her name. Allison.
Oh, Allison, yeah.
Yes, I wanted to call her Hermit Thrush Lady, and I was like, no, username.
She was a guest on the show last summer when she was in town.
Yes, yeah. It's going to be coming up in May to talk about hermit thrushes and hopefully do a little hermit thrush banding.
Oh, nice.
So we'll get that going. We're still working on a couple of others. Actually, I have pretty much a full slate. I'm just like solidifying dates, so as soon as I have those solidified, you will know. And I have this dream, I have this hope that by the time your talk, I will actually have a list of dates and names to hand out.
So within the next couple of weeks,
Couple of weeks. I'm pretty sure I'm that close.
All right.
Very, very close. So yeah, I know we're going to hear a little bit about Mendenhall Glacier and the carbon. I think people might have heard a little bit about the carbon that ends up kind of on top of the ice.
So the soot, basically.
The soot, yeah. Mm-hmm. I believe Aaron Hood's going to come over from UIS in Juneau and talk with us about that. And who knows? We might have others. There's lots of things in the works.
Yes.
Everyone's agreed in principle. So we're just like, it's like I said, they're volunteering. They're working it into their schedule. So I'm always very pleased when people agree to come and talk.
Well, and if anybody out there has ideas for subjects they'd like to hear about, can't always find speakers for them, but it seems
like... Or if someone knows a speaker.
Or if you know a speaker.
Yeah, and I'll often say, well, great, well, send your... And oftentimes it's people's friends, someone they have worked with or went to school with or something that ends up being... pretty interesting. So send me that information or give me a call over at the university. And I'd love to hear about it. I can't always make it happen, but I can try.
Well, and you mentioned Pat Druckenmiller there. And so I should say that I do have a recording of a conversation I did with him while he was here this past November, I guess it was. And I'll be using that for a future show. I'm not quite sure whether that'll be in the next couple of weeks or next month or so or further out. But yeah, many of the speakers that you've brought in, I've had the opportunity to speak with here for the radio. So that's been a fun thing, and I appreciate your bringing them in and.
Yeah, I really like that too, because people are always asking me, well, I'm going to miss that. Are you going to record it? And I'm like, no.
Not usually. Yeah.
Well, it's just one more thing, and I'm not a videographer, mm-hmm. and I think it takes some skill to actually make those good presentations. So I'm not signing up for that. I feel pretty good if I get it organized and set up. So if someone's really keen on doing that and making those available, I am more than happy to have them. But for now, what I've enjoyed is that people are coming in recording a conversation with you. So if you miss the main talk, you can come in or you can listen on the radio.
Often, yeah.
Often, and, not all the time.
And not
but
always
often.
Right away.
Right, but it's usually there. So yeah there's ways that that person's information and enthusiasm is being captured.
Yeah, and it's been a lot of fun to talk to folks. You know, sometimes I've been like, well, man, I don't even know anything. I don't know what I'll talk to them about. But inevitably, you know, it's stuff that they're interested in, and it's not really been that difficult to sort of get excited about it with them. So we have the other one that you mentioned was Allison Nelson, Hermit
yes.
Thrush Lady,
who was lady.
Here last summer. And for those of you who didn't happen to catch that show, her reason for visiting, she's probably the only one in history who has ever visited Southeast Alaska for this reason. But she visited the motivation for her trip was that she banded hermit thrushes in the Bay Area of California, sort of North Bay and South Bay area, I guess two different places. And the birds in the southern banding location with geolocators, this is a project she worked on, I think, for a couple of years. And what they found was that those birds nested, at least in part, in Southeast Alaska. And so she was like, I haven't been there. I'd like to go visit and see where my hermit thrushes are going.
Cool.
So I thought that was a lot of fun. So she had got in touch with, I think, somebody in Juneau and said, hey, is there anybody in Sitka? And so then had gotten in touch with you and I. And so I had a chance to spend, I think showed him around town. Her and her husband were in town and did a little birding and we went up Harbor Mountain, I think, although the weather wasn't fabulous.
There were hermit thrushes up there.
There were hermit thrushes. And actually, just this week, I saw, unfortunately, it was a little late for count week, which we should talk about our Christmas bird count here for a couple minutes. But the hermit thrush, braving the cold, they do sometimes straggle. This is getting to be quite late for them. It's not terribly unusual to see them into November and December, but by January, they're pretty much probably either dead or gone, one of the two. So it was interesting to see that hermit thrush. And my son told me that today he saw an American pipit, which was also one that would have been a nice bird for the count. So Christmas bird count was last Sunday. Do you have any? I know that's one of the things that you've sort of prioritized over the years. Do you have any stories you'd like to or highlights from this year's or prior year's bird counts that you'd like to share or not?
I'm like going, huh? not especially. What I was thinking of when you said too late for that count was that there's the Great American Backyard Bird Count.
Oh, yeah. I don't think it's limited to America, but the Great Backyard Bird Count.
Right.
Yeah.
That's coming up in February. So maybe some of these birds, like there's been a rusty blackbird and the spotted towhee and all, you know, the pipit now and the hermit thrush, who knows? Maybe they'll be around. And that's not just a one day. That's like 4 days of counting. But you don't have to like spend all 4 days counting.
You know, President's
Day
weekend. Yeah, it's run in a very different fashion than the Christmas bird count is. For better and worse, I mean, it's just different kind of data, and it doesn't have the same sort of community thing where you gather together and pick your routes and then get together at the end and share it. You could, but you enter independently, whereas Christmas bird counts always have compilers. And so that is one, and we'll probably maybe try, and that would be a good weekend to do a birding mm-hmm. big year, part of the big, under the big year umbrella that we were talking about earlier, kind of a little birding walk, maybe if Ranger Ryan Carpenter's mm-hmm. around, and maybe by that time you'd have the ability, if he's around, and might be willing to lead a walk down at the park or maybe we'll go out to Stargavin or something. But I think that would be a nice time. That's usually President's Day weekend.
That's what I was just trying to check the
it's
dates on.
Usually
it.
Early to mid-February, somewhere in there.
Oh, it's February 17th through February 20th.
Okay. So
Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday. And that's the nice part is that it is 4 days. So if like one of the days the weather is like foul, you can go out the next day, you know, and it's, you know, you don't have to do all day. You never have to do all day with any of these counts. It's totally up to you, but, it's kind of fun. I usually use it as an assignment for my natural history class, that I teach for the university. 'Cause it's a great way to get one. I always think I tell my students they should be getting a PE credit for my natural history class as well, because I want them outside.
Well, it's funny. You know, it's like I'm sitting here thinking, well, okay, Christmas break. These all really sound like excuses to go out and look at stuff.
They are.
And that's pretty much, yeah. I mean, we don't really need excuses, I guess, but you know how life is. You sometimes just are like, oh, do I really want to get up off the couch today? Well, some of us are very active anyway, but I'm one of those, like, I'm sitting here and I'm doing stuff. Do I really want to get out? And I have already in the first week this year gotten out far more than you know, over any single week period of most of last year, even in the summertime. And it's simply, you know, and it's not like I'm spending a huge amount of time out every day. It's just that it motivates me to get up and go look around. I'm like, oh, I got to go see some species for my big year project. And that's, I mean, it's just good for you to get out and, you know, not even from the physical standpoint, but mental well-being standpoint, time in nature apparently makes a difference for folks. And so
your holistic wellness.
Holistic wellness. That's
there
a
good, go.
Good word for it. So we're supporting your holistic wellness with excuses to get anal about counting numbers and species and things.
You don't have to get anal. You can just enjoy it.
Yes.
Take pictures. Let us know. Share on iNaturalist so we can celebrate you.
Yes. Yes, celebrate you and us and natural history and all of us together. It's all one big fun thing.
Wow.
So I'm excited. But I do want to talk a little bit about the Christmas bird count. I asked Jen and Vicky, who are our compilers and were my guests for the last show, and they haven't got everything compiled yet. It'll be another week or so. But I do know there were some exciting birds for us. The spotted towhee was found on count day, first count. I mean, it had been here since it was first found in December, and so it was nice that it was around. A rusty blackbird, maybe the first. It's not the first one in winter here, because I know I saw one in winter before, but maybe the first time for Christmas bird count. I don't think it was seen on count day, but it was seen on a count on either side, actually, during count week. So that was an interesting one. Spotted sandpiper still around.
Oh, the western grebe.
Western grebe was seen on count day and also, I think, a day or two before that. They are, again, not unheard of in the winter here, but unusual. So those were both good birds. And the other thing that was interesting to me was when I was looking through all the sheets, there was basically, it didn't seem like anything that was expected was missing. And a lot of times there's, you know, you just happen to miss a brown creeper, you miss, you know, American dippers or something. And it seemed like this year, everything that you would expect to see was there. Maybe we didn't have crossbills. Actually, some pine siskins were around. I haven't seen any myself, but some folks saw pine siskins. Another exciting one was a short-eared owl showed up over at the airport, not on count day, but within a day or two after. There was a northern shrike before the count. I think you'd actually seen a northern shrike over at the airport
on a count day
10 years ago or something like that.
Yeah, just a couple of days ago. Yeah,
it's been a little while.
Yeah, I've seen one in my yard before too, which is pretty fun. But shrikes are rare enough that I can tell you about the times I've seen them in Sitka.
I've only seen one, and that was and I only remember hearing about a handful of others in the last 10 years or so, and for whatever reason that kind of information tends to stick in my head. So so they're not typical birds here. Part of that may be habitat, but I think also they just don't come out here that often. You know, magpies are another one that if you go to Juneau or Gustavus, you know, you'll see magpies and they're not that unusual, but for whatever reason, they don't seem to come out here very, very often. So it was a good bird count, good participation. I'm not
sure.
Nice
weather.
Yeah, nice weather. It was not, I mean, there's a little bit of a breeze, but like a couple, maybe it was last year or the year before, and it was sunny but cold. This year it was sunny and not so cold. Yeah, it was cool. It was a little hard out on the water to see birds along a shoreline if the shore was south of you, which it often was. For where the bird count circle goes. So that was one of those. Still, I'll take the sun
over, that was okay.
Over nasty, windy, rainy, can't see anything anyway conditions. So it was a great bird count. Hope you got a chance to participate in it if you wanted. And if not, maybe you'll get a chance next year. I think that Jen and Victoria will be running it again, so it will no doubt be the last. It's either the very end of – it's essentially the last weekend that they can do it. And so it's usually within like the 30th to the 4th, depending on how the weekends fall. And I'm not sure how that's going to be next year, but you can put it on your calendar if you plan that far
that's
in
right.
advance.
I'm already all hyped up for the February one.
That's right.
And because we're doing this big year thing, I have a feeling that we will now again be competitive species-wise for Sitka. With some of the other towns that usually beat us. And they will probably beat us anyway, but we have a better chance of being competitive if there's actually a compelling reason for folks to go out there and look.
Yeah, and sometimes that folks is me, I guess, because I the first years I did the Great Backyard Bird Count, there was this really clear page where you could look at all the cities in Alaska that had submitted observations to the Backyard Bird Count, and I was like, Sitka's number one. We weren't number one, but usually we were in the top three. And so I was really motivated to get out. And then when they changed the format a little bit and they changed it to an eBird-based thing, then I became a little less inspired about it.
But you can still see the city stuff.
Yeah, they you couldn't the first year.
Yeah, they fixed that. So you can see that. So birding is competitive, just in case you were wondering. And if you're not normally a sports person, this could be your sport.
It can be competitive. It doesn't have to. It's fun to get how many numbers you can. I don't like to compete against people that I know, but those guys over there in the other town.
In Kodiak, yeah. We beat them.
Yeah, it is part of it's just competing against yourself as well. It's like, can I see more than I did last time? Or can I get all the birds that I know are around?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the other thing that I like to do. It's like, I know there are Bohemian waxwings around. Can I find them?
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, through the network. I might not find them myself, but can I, you know, ask people? And so that's one of the great things over the years that as I've sort of learned more people, got to know more people, I guess is the way I want to put that. And hearing about what folks are seeing out there has been really great. And as in turn has allowed me to see a lot more, which then I try to share with others as best I can. And so I'm kind of running out of time here. Is there anything else that you'd like to add in just before I close it out?
You know, the one thing we didn't talk about that I've really been enjoying is actually the stars the constellations. There's been a really cool, and you can see it, you know, any night it's clear, probably this week. Venus is the bright star to the south, which means, I guess, it's a planet, sorry. And just up to the south, up to the left, is Mars. It's been this really nice lineup. And when the moon was not quite a full quarter, there was a really lovely lineup of the moon and Mars and Venus. And that's been really fun to enjoy. So don't forget that natural history happens at night, too.
And this time of year, you don't even have to stay up late for it.
No.
You can go out after dinner or even before dinner.
Before dinner.
And check out the stars out there. And if you're adventurous, I've been enjoying looking for the green flash. I saw the mm-hmm. best one I've seen by far earlier this week. So that was exciting for me.
And the green flash is?
The green flash is when the sun just drops below the horizon and there's the light gets bent around in a way. And I could talk for another 5 minutes, but if I do, I'll run over, and the classical music show will have to start late. So I probably better not do that, but I will be posting on my website a weblog post about the green flash with some pictures of that event that I saw. Actually, same day I saw the short-eared owl, which was another exciting one for me. So if you're interested in seeing that, you can go to sitkanature.org and look for my weblog there. If you go to sitkanature.org/raven, you can find recordings of past shows. Or you get on Facebook and like the Sitka Nature show or Sitka Nature page there. I've been posting links to weblog posts and including links to old shows as well as other photos that I think folks might be interested in. And today I actually posted a link to a video of some of those wind and water swirls that I was seeing out at Silver Bay. So that was kind of fun. Also, I'd love to hear what you're seeing out there. If you're seeing any birds that seem interesting to you or unusual in any way, please feel free. You can send me a message on Facebook or just send me an email, sitkanature@gmail.com. It's always great to hear what folks are seeing out there. And so I want to, as I close out here, just say thanks, Kitty, for joining me this week. And we'll look forward to being back in a couple of weeks. And if you want to go, you can check out the talk on the 19th of January. I'll be talking about big years, natural history, and lots of cool pictures of Sitka.
Exactly. Thanks for having me on your show.
All right. Thanks. Until next time, this has been Matt on the Sitka Nature Show, KCAW, Sitka.